You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome back to TFM's local watering hole and back to the grid. Oh my gosh, it is looking fantastic here. A little bit redder than usual. I'm more of a blue guy, but I'm super glad to have back with me the program who has become a user, Scott McClellan.
No, it's just biodigital jazz, man.
Oh, goodness. Well, we're going to be diving, of course, back into the Tron universe since Tron Ares has come out. And before we do that, of course, you know, find us wherever you get your podcast. Help us out. Give us star ratings, reviews, all that stuff. You guys know that. But if you're listening to the show and you've never done that, help us out. Help us grow. Also, share us out on social media. One of the best ways to grow podcasts is by a personal recommendation from a friend on social media or in person. Of course, you can find us on social media. We're on X, Twitter, at the 602 Club. We're on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. You can find the entire network on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, as well as finding us online at trek.fm. Plus, you could support us on Patreon. So if you do like all the things we're trying to do here on the network, go over to Patreon, patreon.com/trekfm, and make sure that all of this content can keep coming to you. And it's not cheap to do all that. But so, Scott, I just want to ask you this, you know, before we get started. You weren't on our other previous Tron episodes, but I think it's kind of an interesting thing to start the conversation this way, in the sense of Tron is one of the most strange experiences and experiments that Disney has been doing with franchises, and in the sense of like trying to revive a franchise. And I mean, because originally the original film becomes a cult classic, but it doesn't do well at the box office.
No, it doesn't. No, actually, I think it's funny to say that really that statement qualifies for every Tron movie ever made.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Tron Legacy is not a big hit at the theater either. And yet there are a ton of people like myself who really responded to the movie, loved the movie, championed the movie, you know. And so I wanted to ask you, just kind of even coming into this idea, knowing that we're going to be getting a sequel to these two films. How are you even feeling about the idea of trying to bring this back? Before we even talk about the fact that, you know, what the sequel is and all that, I just wanted to know, how are you feeling with the idea of, like, trying this again? Because this is the third go-around at this point.
Honestly, my reaction the entire time was, oh, they're making a new Tron movie. Like that was my reaction. I was going to see it because it was a Tron movie. Like, that's all I needed. The first movie qualifies under the cool, you know, we all have that list of name a movie from the year you were born. And the first Tron movie is, you know, one of those. You know, I get E.T., Blade Runner, and Tron. Like, that's like my top three of movies from the year I was born. And it was a part of my childhood growing up, that first movie. You know, I have a hard time remembering when I finally watched it start to finish for the first time. But it was still one of those movies that, as a kid, it comes on TV, or you get the VHS and you don't from the library or something. You don't quite finish it every time. But yeah, if it's on TV, you'll stop and watch whatever part's on. And that's what Tron was for me. So I was, when it came to Ares coming out, I was like, cool, they're making another one. And that's pretty much where I fell.
Yeah, I mean, this is just an interesting thing because, you know, the original itself is such a strange movie. I mean, you know, it really just is a strange film. And yet, it's a movie that I have an immense amount of affection for, even as kind of strange and weird. It's just an interesting idea in general. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, people kind of latched onto it and it became this cult classic. And of course, it's a film that where they're trying lots of weird things, even, you know, technologically, what you could do and mixing that with computers and all of those kind of things. And so, but, and then, you know, for me, Legacy came out and that was a film that I thought, one, was beautiful, two, took the franchise in a very interesting direction and one that I wanted then to see a follow-up for. And so as we were coming into this, I was excited about the idea because they've been talking about making another Tron film for a very long time. And so knowing that another one was coming, I was excited for. And yet, here's the rub. We're going to continue this story, but this is not going to be a sequel in the same sense of originally Joseph Kosinski was going to come back and do a sequel. And then they scrapped that because of the failure of Tomorrowland at the box office. That's really what kind of put the nail in the coffin for him being able to come back and do a Tron film. And so I wanted to ask you that specifically, that we're not going to follow up a movie that have this, you know, had this dangling thread, right? And had a very big story point just hanging out there waiting to be explored. And yet we're going to make Ares now, and that really doesn't have anything to do necessarily with the big questions asked by or left to us by Legacy. And so how did you feel about that idea then of continuing the story and knowing, yeah, that we're not really going to touch that? I mean, it will reference a few things here and there, but in the end, this is going to kind of chart its own direction.
I didn't mind it, honestly. I was watching the movie. Like, I did not pay enough attention that detailed in the lead up to the movie to know that they weren't going to be dealing with any of those issues from Legacy. I discovered that as I was watching the movie. Yet, by the end of the movie, I like how Ares goes, oh no, we haven't forgotten about Legacy. We were just kind of telling our own story right now. And by the end of the movie, I appreciated the fact that at least it goes, no. We know there's Legacy. We know there's threads out there. You know, mm-hmm. The next one.
Right.
You know, that's what it felt like. It felt like a promise of the next one will get there. And it didn't bother me because for me, Legacy, I didn't see Legacy in theaters. I don't know why I didn't. There's a portion of like the mid to late 2000s that there are movies that I just didn't see for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I can't tell you why. Well, I probably could tell you why. Working, going to school, getting married.
Right. That'll
life
do
was
it.
Busy. That'll do it. You know, that 2005 to 2010, there was stuff going on. But it did not disappoint me because, like most things, when I go see a movie, my philosophy is always I'm going to look at the movie that is being presented to me. And this is not an original thought by me, so I can't take credit for it. But it's like I was watching a tie-in. You know, if you think about like comic book events and there's always the tie-in story, like this felt like we're still playing in the same universe. We're telling a story that hopefully is going to play into the bigger story, but we're going to divert and pay attention to something else. And so I appreciated Tron Ares and the fact that it diverted from the Flynn storyline a little bit to explore the Dillingers. And I appreciated that because you got Cillian Murphy in Legacy for like 5 minutes as a Dillinger. And that's all you get in Legacy. So it was interesting to follow up on the legacy of David Warner's character from the first movie and kind of give them a movie to flesh out that pocket of the universe. So, like I said, it was a windy, that was a long-winded answer to your simple question, but it basically was like, it was a movie in the Tron universe. I did not specifically need it to be a direct continuation of Legacy. I just wanted a entertaining, well-made Tron movie. And So that's what I was watching Ares for.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting thing just because for me, my response to them doing this was coming into the film then and just legitimately having zero expectations, because what I really did want was to follow up a movie that I actually love in Legacy. I wanted to see that continuation of that. Now, I think what you said is kind of interesting, because it does almost feel as though it's a tie-in film, in the sense that this movie is more about the Dillingers, like, in that sense. Like, yes, they're kind of the villains in this film, but in a lot of ways, they're also the more interesting protagonists in the film, because there has always been this fighting back and forth between NCOM and the Dillinger systems, you know, since the first film. And this kind of shines a spotlight on that. And, you know, not to get to the end here, but it's like where this movie ends then, it's almost like they're trying, their goal was to kind of bring things full circle almost, right? And hopefully, I'm my guess was, is then, you know, you would have a satisfying conclusion, you know, where it's like if you watched the first movie and then you watched maybe a fourth movie, if they ever got a chance to do one, we'll have that discussion later, but it would feel like this kind of full circle moment almost. And so with that, then the fact that this story became more about not being inside the grid, but bringing the grid to the real world, through this, you know, kind of virtual 3D printing process of things from the grid into our universe, but, you know, they can only last for 29 minutes before deresolution. How did you feel about that idea too? Because that's also a shift. One of the big things about the Tron movies was, you know, going to the grid was the part that people were kind of waiting for. And in this movie, we actually spend, what, like maybe 7 minutes in the grid, really? Like, we don't spend a ton of time in the grid. Most of this movie actually takes place in our world. And so how did you feel about that shift in the story?
To grid or not to grid?
That is the question.
To grid or not to grid. It didn't bother me that we weren't in the, because we've gone through two whole movies that the whole conceit of them are a user is sucked into the grid. I always describe Tron as the pioneer of the protagonist gets sucked into a video game subgenre of science fiction. Like, that became, I think because of Tron, that became a thing, you know. We get things like Captain N, the Game Master, or Ready Player One, you know, because of this concept of someone inside of a game. And I think Tron started that. And then Legacy was, okay, now let's put Flynn's son. Let Flynn's son get sucked into the game. And I feel like this movie was, okay, well, what's the point, again, of going into the grid? Because even Legacy ends with Sam and Quora coming into the real world. So in a way, if you want to, if you're looking for your continuation of Legacy, okay, Quora and Sam got out of the grid and they ended up in the real world. Well, then isn't that the logical next step? Is that we've been sucking people into the grid. Well, now how about we use the grid to bring things alive in the real world? And so for me, it kind of just felt, it didn't feel like an interruption. It just felt like a progression of the universe. So I didn't mind it. And honestly, it was kind of cool seeing, you know, recognizers and light cycles and all of that in the real world. Because we'll also talk later on about the VFX in this movie, which I think are just freaking incredible. So, but that for me, that was the cool. And that always was kind of the hook. Like the trailers led you to see this is the hook of this film mm-hmm. is they're in our world now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've heard some people kind of complain a little bit about
I'm shocked. Really? People complain?
Of the fact of coming to our world with this stuff. But I think that the point that you made about, you know, how Legacy ended, where you're bringing the digital world to the real world, and then this movie became about, okay, what if you could take things from the grid and bring them to the real world? And I mean, in some ways, I think, look, this just deals with the where we are now anyway, which is, you know, we're 3D printing things. We're turning ideas that we create in a computer and turning them into reality in a very crude way, right? But that's what we're doing. And so the idea of kind of taking all of these things that we've seen, these incredible creations on the grid and bringing them to our world is fascinating. Now, I will say the one thing that when I stopped and thought about it for like 2 seconds,
don't do that. Don't think.
It actually doesn't work though, because none of those things would be able to work in our world because the grid has its own sense of like universe, right? And its own laws and how things work, you know. But you couldn't bring a recognizer and have it fly in our universe. That just doesn't.
Why not? Why not, Matt?
I know. I put a little bit too much thought into it.
Fictional characters.
Yeah, I know. It's a fictional universe where, you know, they've got, you know, they're gonna have this whole idea of, you know, searching for permanence and making things permanent that were once not permanent. And so, and that, see, this is the thing that was actually interesting to me though about the film, was that whole idea of searching for permanence and
its mortality.
Yes, exactly. Because in the idea of you know, these companies, what they want to be able to do is to create digital constructions that become permanent, and therefore you could solve the food crisis, right?
Well, it goes back to what Flynn is talking about in Legacy, yes, which is how do we use the digital world to make our real world a better world? And then you see Incom continuing that. Well, then you get Dillinger doing what Dillinger would do. How can we get a military contract off of this?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, and so I really liked that idea of the permanence and impermanence, though, because, as you know, especially as we bring the Ares program into our world, and he has to deal with the fact that by becoming permanent, he actually is becoming the most impermanent possible, because there is only one life. There's no reset button. You know, there is no coming back. And I really enjoyed the process of watching this character become obsessed with the real world, experiences in the real world, learning what it was like to have feelings, you know, like the feeling of rain and these kind of things. And in the end, I thought that this movie was doing this very good theme for the world in which we live, where we have become so obsessed with our digital lives and our digital selves, the things that we put out there in the digital space, that they have been impacting who we are in reality, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas it was interesting to have this movie kind of try to remind us that, no, what's actually real is what's happening all around you in the real world. Like how precious life really is when it's really real and not something we're just making up. And the experiences that we have and all of that, that's what's important. And I found that to be an incredibly fascinating thing for this movie to be trying to help us to see. You know, it's not about these fantasy lives that we're creating in the digital world that we're trying to pull into the real world. It's about being a part of the real world and making change. It's about making things happen in the real world. It's about living our life in the real world. It's about experiencing the things in the real world. And that's what really matters. All of this other stuff is just, you know, digital make-believe. And to me, that whole idea was really interesting. I did not expect this movie, you know, to kind of hit on that kind of level.
Well, and as you were talking, I also am thinking about, like, the conflict in Legacy was between Flynn and Clue, and Clue trying to fulfill his programming about creating a perfect world. And Flynn having to come to the realization, yeah, that doesn't mean what I thought it meant. You know, you really can't be perfect, because trying to be perfect leads to the genocidal, you know, whitewashing that Clue was doing in Legacy. So then it was interesting for Ares to be, I want this permanence code, this MacGuffin of the film. I did at some point a lot of times. Every time they talk about permanence, I was like, okay, MacGuffin, 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 MacGuffin. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of interesting to go, I want to... It's like Ares was saying, I want to stop dying over and over again.
Right. Yeah.
But then I also like how the shadow of Flynn in the original grid basically goes, yeah, but you do realize that means is that when you do die, mm-hmm. it's for real. And I just thought that was such an interesting... It was such an interesting concept. And as a Highlander fan, I did find it appropriate that while they don't do the Queen song, Nine Inch Nails wrote a song for the soundtrack that was also called Who Wants to Live Forever. And... So as a Highlander fan, that idea of everyone says they want to live forever until they actually get it, and then it's that story of what happens when you do. I mean, Interview with a Vampire does this, you know, the idea that living forever is not the cool thing that you think it is, because forever is forever, and eventually you get tired of it. And for Ares, it was just an interesting way of going, looking at permanence, looking at mortality in a way that was, I never actually get to live. I can exist. I think that's it. I can exist forever, but to truly live, I need the ability to die, to hurt, to be real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of what does it mean to truly live and to truly have kind of an impact on the world around you. And the realest thing and the most defining thing about human nature is the fact that we die. And so, therefore, the things that we do in the span of our life, they can either resonate for long periods of time after we die, or they can mean nothing because we didn't do anything important, right? We did, and I think that was the beauty, again, coming back to that idea of that spending all of this time in our lives trying to make the fantasy reality is to lose all that it means to be a human being, right? What it really truly means to be a human being is to deal with reality on its own terms and to make something of yourself in that, you know, in the difficulty, in the struggle. And that's the thing that I just keep coming back to when I think about this movie, because I just did not expect that to happen in this film. You know, I did not expect there to be that depth. And I think you picked up correctly, you know, the fact that this movie does have a continuation in that sense from the legacy of realizing, yes, I can't make a perfect world because human beings are incapable of being perfect, because we're not perfect beings and we never will be. The struggle comes in trying to make the world a better world, right? That's as good as we can do, because we're all these, you know, sinful, craven human beings. And so therefore, it's what do we do to rise above our base nature and do something for the good of all humanity, you know, to rise above the level of, you know, pettiness and, you know, selfishness. And that's really kind of what this came down to, right? You know, that's something that we've talked about so many times. You know, Christy and I had talked about so many times here in the 602 Club. You know, in general, so many of these movies come down to that classic idea that Lucas talked about with Star Wars, about, you know, there being a selfishness and a selflessness. And which side of the aisle are you going to be on? You know, in the NCOM side here, as you know, picked up by the Kims, you know, inherited from Flynn there, was this idea of selflessness. You know, we want to create, you know,
we want to create a better world. Exactly. We want to give something to the world. Mm-hmm. Like, it was starting to be that way in Legacy, because Sam's whole thing was,
yes,
you know, giving away the operating system for free.
Yeah. Yep. Why are we scalping people for something, that, you know, we then have to make them have, you know, 47 patches too, because we know it's riddled with mistakes and all that kind of stuff.
Or did we do anything different? Like, I love what the CEO says in Legacy, but we slapped a 12 on it and released it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, no, I think you're right. You know, in that sense, you know, this is kind of a spiritual sequel in that way, because thematically it's picking up those things. And, you know, we'll talk about it there as we kind of talk about the end. But there is a way in which, too, those themes are then connecting to Legacy and the original Tron that would hopefully, you know, bring this full circle. Probably the most divisive thing about this film was Jared Leto being in it. You know, a lot of people...
Yes, I would agree with that.
They just do not like him as an actor, and that's his own fault, in all honesty. But I wanted to ask you, you know, he's one of the main catalysts behind making sure this film happened. And, of course, he is the main character in the film. And what did you think of him and his portrayal? And is he a detriment to this movie? Or does he actually surprisingly make it work?
That is, unfortunately, a very complicated question with a very complicated answer. Is it a detriment? Well, I think that depends on how much of the audience was turned off by the existence of Jared Leto in this movie. And that's a question I can't answer, because something that I have learned over my many years of podcasting and streaming is that those of us who are plugged in know a lot more details and care a lot more than the general audience does. So we may know about some of the weirdnesses and quirks or ickiness of Jared Leto, depending on where you fall. But how much does the general audience really care? How much do they actually know? So that's question number one. So if you see Jared Leto as a detriment, is Jared Leto only a detriment from his existence in the film based on a very hardcore group of film Twitter who knows things and then lets that dictate what they do or do not see? Now, if you just take it from it, flip it and then look at the general audience perspective of probably people who, if they even know who Jared Leto is by name, except for, hey, I think I remember that guy in Dallas Buyers Club or something, you know, something like that. His performance, for me, it works in the movie. I mean, I know Jared Leto isn't a stiff actor. I saw House of Gucci. He was a caricature in that movie, but it still showed that he isn't cardboard in everything that he does. So he was playing the character as written, in my opinion. I mean, you're talking about a security program, a soldier who has no feelings, but is discovering feelings throughout the film. I thought that worked. And like most of the rest of the Tron, you might suggest that relationships, but the Tron franchise has never been something that's been had a lot of romance or sexuality or in it. And the closest you get is the first movie when Flynn and, heaven forgive me, I can never remember the name of the programmer who created Tron because it's Bruce Boxleitner. And, you know, Flynn's ex-girlfriend, them talking about her leaving her clothes on the floor is about as close to any kind of sexuality as you right. get in this yeah. franchise. So I feel like he was there to be the stoic soldier, and he does that, and he can act with his eyes in a way that he's expressing things visually. So I think my complicated answer to your complicated question is, it didn't bother me none, but I really do think that if you think Jared Leto's a detriment to this film, I think that's really kind of on a case-by-case basis, based on how do you feel about Jared Leto as an actor? How do you feel about Jared Leto as a person? And do you let those feelings affect a movie with facts outside of the movie? Like you, when you bring in your own baggage into watching a film, is that on you or is that on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got all the points that you made are great in the sense of, you know, I know that there are a lot of people who have become aware of, you know, Jared Leto and his strange proclivities and everything. And in many ways, it seems as though in the last few years, he started to really kind of change and back off a lot of that stuff. And in the end, it really did come down to exactly what you were talking about. Does he do what he needs to do with this computer program becoming sentient, basically, becoming real? You know, I'm a real boy. And so, and that's exactly what you need from him, is for him to be able to portray the journey of going from something that only runs through an algorithm to something that becomes human in its emotion and its feeling, its understanding, and it's that awakening, right? That happens.
It's weird. You just because you made the I'm a real boy joke. I realized they try to make connections to Frankenstein in this movie, but I feel like Pinocchio is the better metaphor.
Yeah. No, I agree. You know,
which being a Disney product would have been a more kind of a wink and a nod in universe? I don't know.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think you're absolutely right. And in that, I thought Jared Leto did a great job, actually. I thought he was exactly what the movie needed, especially as he kind of slowly becomes more and more a person. I mean, that moment right there at the end where he's talking with Eve, you know, as they're sitting against the car, was kind of like the culmination moment of that. And, you know, him being able to use a little bit of humor there. And that whole thing I thought was really well done. I thought they did a great job. And so, to me, Leto is not a detriment to this film. He's actually a benefit to this film because his portrayal is exactly what you wanted for this character. And a part of that, too, becomes, you know, his reaction to Dillinger and the misuse that he's been used, right? Like he's basically is just a slave to his master. And there is that sense to this, right? This idea that we could just create a slave race through this, you know, digital 3D printing.
And not only but as they say in the movie, expendable.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so for the character of Ares to become more human in that sense, to realize this is happening to him and to break free, you know, it was great. I thought Leto actually did a great job in that. So I had to ask you about this too, because Greta Lee plays Eve Kim, you know, who is on this project in search of the permanence code. And I just wanted to ask you about this. It felt like to me the one thing that the movie didn't do, even at the beginning, was explain how the company of NCOM ends up in the Kim's hands in the first place.
Oh no, that was just that was boom. We got that little, they mimic the prologue structure from Legacy, where it's like, we're just going to give you through news footage,
yes,
all the exposition you need, yes, so we can just jump right into the story that we want to tell.
Which is not a terrible idea. I just felt like it would have been nice for us to kind of have this understanding of how in the world do the Kims end up with the control of NCOM when Sam steps down for personal reasons, right? And I otherwise, you know, I thought that Greta Lee was good in the film. I thought she did a great job with everything she was asked to do. You know, there was nothing about it that was off or missing or anything like that. I liked the relationship, obviously, she has with her sister, and in this whole thing of, you know, trying to prove herself, because really she was more on the game development side than she was this, you know, humanitarian side, and her having to make this switch and all that I thought was really interesting, really good. And, you know, there was nothing off about that or bad about that. I just wish that we had a little bit more introduction to the Kims in general, and kind of how they knew the Flynns. You know, it would have been interesting if there had been some sort of relational aspect between the Flynns and the Kim family or something, or, you know, Kevin had taken an interest in them before he left because that family, because, you know, they were getting it, basically, you know, and so these daughters had been raised in this environment, and you know, something would have helped, but it had nothing to do with the actress. I think she did a good job, and she was interesting enough character for the film, and in the end, that's kind of what
she was mean. Real enough. That was the thing.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, there was enough, and they gave her enough again. You know, with her sister having died and all of that stuff, and her trying to complete this project, not only for then Flynn, but also for really more for her sister. I think
which
that
I also appreciated the way that the film. We didn't get an exposition dump at the beginning or at any moment. It was literally like parceled, like we get a little bit when Ares like goes through her digital profile. But then we also get the car ride, you know, where she shares more. Like, I like the way, I hate it when there's just like the one info dump scene. I like it when you like, you parcel out, you know, you dole out a little bit to me throughout the film for me to discover the full picture. And Tron does that. Like, Ares does that, with the exception of the fact that, yeah, the beginning of the movie is like a oh, we're just going to throw you in the deep end and see if you can swim. Because that's, like, that the beginning of that film is, especially if you saw an IMAX like I did, you got the 9-inch nails, like, boom, 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 boom. You know, like, it's a lot to experience at one time before the film kind of settles into itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I can agree with that. What did you think about, you know, you've got Evan Peters and then Gillian Anderson playing the Dillingers, and, you know, Evan Peters is, you know, he's the one who's running the company. You know, we don't get any, you know, Cillian Murphy at all, any even mention of him, really. But they're the ones who have picked up the mantle of the Dillinger family now and are running the show. And how did that end up working for you, especially, you know, with the way in which we kind of end for that character basically turning into Sark?
Yeah. I enjoyed Evan Peters in this movie. You know, the only really other thing I've experienced him with was, you know, being Quicksilver in Fox X-Men. You know, that's really the only other... he might be one of those actors that if you started naming off all the roles, I go, oh, yeah, I did see that. But really, when I think of Evan Peters, I think of Quicksilver. And that's... So, for him being in this movie, he's a little one-dimensional. I don't blame Evan Peters. I blame the writing for him. Like, he's just... I'm the maniacal control freak, evil CEO who loses all logical sense because I am obsessed with achieving my one goal kind of character. But he plays it to the hilt, and it's not like it's boring to watch. Yeah, we'll talk about how his character ends up at the end of this film, but you know, he's impetuous, he's young. You know, you get that idea of when you talked about the selflessness versus the selfishness. You know, you've got, I don't know, how old is Evan Peters? Like, he's in his 30s. You know, I don't know, but I felt like between Kim and Dillinger, you get two people from the same generation. And you can see what happens when they have two completely different motivations. You know, and you get two people, same age, working for the same ultimate goal, the permanence code, but their reasons for it are polar opposite. And so it plays itself out in a very sort of light side, dark side, you know, kind of way. But, you know, it's also a science fiction movie. And while we've been talking about the philosophical depth that the film has, if you want to pay attention to it, the character, the Dillinger is just kind of, he's the bad guy. You know, and Gillian Anderson was just, you know, British mother. Mm-hmm. Like, she really didn't do anything terribly special in the film, except for B. Gillian Anderson.
Yeah, I agree. So. Yeah, you know, with the Peters role, I think one of the most interesting parts of this is that in many ways, I think his character is one-dimensional, but I think there is a reason for that in the movie, because he has become obsessed with this idea that, you know, he can make fantasy reality in a really bad way, in the sense that it has given this God complex to him, right?
Yes.
And that is why I think it actually works for him to be one-dimensional, because anybody who goes down that road and has this God complex, you kind of lose all sense of reality. I mean, there's no other way to put it. And so I think that's what made him kind of an interesting character in that he has no compunction about doing whatever he has to do to complete the mission that he has for this company and to be able to, you know, make his fantasies reality. And he doesn't care what it takes, you know, because he's put himself in this kind of godlike place. And it then becomes, you know, so interesting, because Anderson really only exists there, I think, to be killed by her son and to show the extent to which he's lost it completely, you know? And that is, I think, all of that is done relatively well, I think, in the movie. And so, it, you know, you're right, though. Anderson doesn't really have a ton to do. And they don't give her a ton to do. And, you know, really, she's just there to be the warning for her son and kind of
that he completely ignores.
Exactly. So, but obviously, this movie does bring back Jeff Bridges with Kevin Flynn because we go back to the original grid from his computer. And so, what did you think about the way in which they utilized him in this film and gave us all that nostalgia trip back to, you know, the grid from the original film, but also done, you know, with the special effects acumen that we have now?
Actually, I have two different responses because I really feel like there's two different questions in there. One, it was a ruin for me because they released a clip online. I didn't watch the clip, but you don't have to watch the clip to get the concept ruined for you. So I knew in some way that Ares was going to end up in the original grid. They showed that. And it's one of those things that was like, damn it, I wish you didn't do that because that would have been really cool to like go, oh, you know, with all the, you know, with the synthesizer and
right. Yep.
The computer graphics of 1981 and 1982.
Yep. Having the bit show up, you know.
Having the bit show up. Yeah. The way they can only answer yes, no. You know, for me, this was like the best nostalgia for me because I started with the first movie. Like so many people love Legacy and I understand I'm there, but my heart, you know, if you want to pull my nostalgia strings, I still have nostalgia for the original Tron movie. So giving me a grid that looks like wire graphics was like, and then the fact that there was the crack in the wall from when Flynn escaped the grid in the first movie. Like I was like, oh, that's such a cool detail. So I enjoyed the section where he's in Flynn's old computer and in the old grid. When it comes to seeing Kevin Flynn in this film, there's like one line of dialogue to explain why he's there because we saw what happened to Flynn in Legacy. And so this isn't the actual Flynn. This is literally a digital ghost of Flynn. But they really wave their hand over the explanation for how he's existing. So I think the conversation that Flynn has with Ares is fantastic. The reason for Flynn existing, like if we're talking about story logic in the movie, is because we wanted to is basically the answer. And so that was the one thing that pulled me out briefly was, well, that was kind of a lame explanation. Because I thought it was going to be the actual Flynn. And I was wondering how they were going to explain how he survived his merging with Clue at the end of Legacy. And kind of like the rest of the film, well, they didn't explain it because it's not that Flynn. It's like a profile in his computer. And I would have just have appreciated a more nuanced logical explanation for what this Flynn is when, no, we basically got, I'm a ghost.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me of that idea of being a digital imprint of your conscious self, or very much the construct of Jor-El in Man of Steel type of thing, right? And so all of that really felt like what this was. And so I didn't really necessarily have a problem with that because it made sense that, you know, this kind of thing could exist, you know, having seen that in other films. And I think it was just fun to be back in that universe. And in the sense, too, that, you know, the permanence code didn't exist on the, you know, full grid. It only existed in this original grid, and it was hidden there on purpose. I thought was an interesting idea, right? Because it's such a dangerous thing to kind of have get out in the wrong hands. And so I liked all that, too. And, you know, I think it was a fun way of kind of reminding us back where we came from, which is, you know, back when the original Tron came out, the internet didn't exist. And so interconnected computers like this wasn't the same thing, you know?
They were hardwired together in a network.
And so all of that, I think, was really fun. And I thought they did a great...
I have to admit, I did enjoy seeing the 5.5 floppies.
Yes. Them going through all the floppies, that was hysterical. Because, yes, I was reminded of playing games on those type of... we had a TI... was it the TI-80 computer? But we had those... games that would be on those type of floppies. So we also had games that were also on cassette tapes. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I had one of those that plugged into my TI. You had to, like, that the tape recorder.
Yes,
plugged
exactly.
Into the
crazy. Anyway.
Wow. Technology has changed so much.
It's definitely changed a lot. I did have to ask this. Okay, so we don't have Daft Punk for the soundtrack this time. We've got Nine Inch Nails. And so I wanted to ask you how you felt about that, because obviously Daft Punk's legacy score is actually just one of the legit best soundtracks out there.
Yes.
It just is so good. And so how does Nine Inch Nails do coming in to, you know, create this score? And basically, I mean, you know, they have a lot to live up to.
It's weird because I feel like that the energy that Nine Inch Nails brings fits with the more Dillinger-focused nature of Aries. If you just want me to say apples to apples, which one do I prefer? I prefer the Daft Punk score on Legacy. I like the sound better of the Daft Punk score. But that doesn't mean that the Nine Inch Nails score is bad. I feel like the Nine Inch Nails score works for this film, but I'm also curious to see the film again, say, like, at home with, like, my home theater system versus the IMAX system, because one thing that I have learned is that sometimes the mix at my IMAX can blow out the soundtrack. And this happened to me back in 2016 when I saw Suicide Squad. The soundtrack overpowered the film, and then I later learned that when I went to a different theater, that wasn't the movie's fault. That was the way that the mix was at IMAX. Because sometimes IMAX can be a lot sound-wise. And there were moments where I was just like, wow, this is pulse-pounding. This is like, I'm going to feel this in my chair. And I actually, for Nine Inch Nails, I like the songs better on the soundtrack than the score itself. Because there's like two or three songs on the soundtrack, and I dig those more so than I dig the instrumental in this film.
I don't. That's interesting. I don't think I love the songs for the most part. I think they're fine. I think there's nothing wrong with them. I thought the soundtrack was good. You know, I think you really, really put your finger on this. This is a soundtrack that actually just reflects the fact that the Dillingers are more of the main characters in this film. And therefore, for the score to have a slightly harder edge to it than what we got in Legacy makes complete sense, right? The fact that, you know, even just that the grid we're going to is all red instead of blue and white, all of that makes sense and really works. So I think they did a great job in that. And so, yeah, I have no problems with it. I think it's very effective. And another thing that's really effective about this film is the fact that the effects I think there is maybe one moment where I was like, ooh, I don't really love that smoke effect in that final battle. Like, it just doesn't, it stood out as like, oh, that wasn't quite as well composited. But just everything else, when they brought the grid world to the real world, all of that stuff was just so good, so well done. I mean, the effects in this movie were just great and exactly what you want them to be, especially if you're going to try and pull this off. And yeah, ILM really kind of knocked it out of the park here.
I it was just, when you see movies like this and you just want to go, y'all, why can't we do this every time?
Yeah,
like
Marvel, what's your deal, man?
What's your deal? Like, I just see these movies that when there are these big blockbusters, why do your effects look like that? Why? But yet, from a movie that comes from the exact same studio, essentially,
mm-hmm.
or the same parent company,
yeah.
can put out a film that you want to go, well, these are impeccable. These are gorgeous. You know, it's, and I feel like, unlike Legacy, because Legacy's effects, with the exception of the very awkward early de-aging of Jeff Bridges, I mean, which is like the one black mark on Legacy. Yeah,
that's also new too. You got to give it that to them, you know.
Like, you got to give it that. I do. It's like, go back and watch the effects in 1982 Tron. Those are kind of rough, but they're also doing something brand new. But I felt like Ares stepped it up because, okay, now let's make all of this exist in the real world. With real world shading, with, you know, it's kind of like on Legacy. At some point, you get used to the de aging because when you get into the grid, he's Clue.
Mm-hmm.
So your brain kind of accepted that. You know, he is a computer program, so him not looking real is, you know, not an issue. But then in Ares, everything is just chef's kiss because the shading, the lighting, the texture. The colors, it all works. And you do believe, I think it also helps that those light cycles were practical for a lot, like they built practical light cycles. You know, there's always something when you have a practical model to use, and then you're just enhancing with digital effects. I always think improves whatever you're trying to do. You know, Siege, Steven Spielberg, Jurassic Park. You know, because if you are, you're trying hard. No one can ding this movie on the visual effects because they are fabulous. And it's just weird that in an age with the technology that we have, we can still be impressed by really good special effects because of how much Hollywood churns out chum special effects.
Yeah, agreed.
In an era that there's no excuse for that.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think, you know, and maybe this is one of those things where, you know, Hollywood should learn, you know, make less things so that more things can look great. And so, this movie, it's doing terrible at the box office. I mean, it's an absolute travesty.
Yeah, it's doing bad.
It's one of the biggest bombs in Disney history. And yet the movie was left on a cliffhanger because we had not only the character of Sark being created as Dillinger got sucked into or sucks himself into the grid and turns into that character, but we also had Ares with a picture of Sam and Korra and seems to be searching for them. Which, you know, would make sense because up until that point, Korra was the only thing we knew that had been spontaneously created in the digital world that then came to the real world as an ISO. And so it did seem as though they had some thought processes where they were going to go. And yet here, like Legacy in some ways, this is actually left on almost a bigger cliffhanger. And yet we'll probably never follow up with it. And so, I mean, How do you feel about that? Because I almost feel like one of the things that I always go back to is that the newer Planet of the Apes films, they legit, for those three films, you know, and I'm not counting necessarily Kingdom, because it's that one felt more like, oh, we want more to come. But the other three were like, we don't know if we're making another film. We're just going to throw everything we possibly can into this movie and make the best movie we can possibly make. And if people want more and we get to make more, great. We'll figure out the problems then of how to continue the story when we get there. And it's hard because I feel like this movie leaves us in that spot where you, if you watch it, you're like, man, well, I kind of want to know what happens next, but now I'll probably never, ever get the answer. And that's almost, it's a frustration to me because I would rather people stop being so enamored with franchise thinking and be more enamored with just let's make the best movie we possibly can. And this was kind of a place where I do feel like that might have helped them more than trying to figure out how do we plant seeds for our next one than how do we just make the best Tron movie we possibly can.
But it wasn't a bad movie either.
No, I'm not saying it is.
I know, okay. That was why I was taking just slight issue with the implication of what you were saying. Because I didn't feel like they were... I didn't feel like they cheated on this movie for franchise. Like, the only thing that I would say is, okay, you leave me... I don't even mind you leaving the ending. Maybe the mid-credit scene with Sark is as much of like, because it was a mid-credit scene. It wasn't just the movie ended and then it goes on. But they made a good movie, in my opinion. And I've seen people's criticisms of the movie. You know, they praise the visuals, they praise the score, they say the story's a little thin. I'm like, what Tron movie does, like, have you watched the other Tron movies? This plot has never exactly been the highlight of any of these films. So it's just like, well, what did you... It's one of those things where I look at the... I don't blame the filmmakers. I look at the audience and go, what do you want? You know, it's... Who's not seeing this movie? Like, I guess that's my question, because no Tron movie has actually been a box office success. So when you make this movie, don't we just accept the fact that it's not going to be a box office? I mean, granted, it's doing terrible. I mean, this is bad, and I'm not ignoring that fact. But it's like, who isn't showing up for this movie? Like that's my question. Why is it doing this badly? No, normally we look at what came out the same time and we say, okay, what pulled the audience away? And I look at the weekend that Tron Ares, the weekend that Tron Ares came out. Nothing else like it came out. So it wasn't like people chose to watch something else rather than Tron Ares. It's just like, people didn't care about another Tron movie.
Well, yeah. And look, I mean, we talk about the fact that Legacy didn't make a ton of money, but the budget was $170 million and worldwide it made $400 million. So not a massive success, no, but not the travesty that this movie is. And so right. I would say this is, look, I'm going to blame Disney with this one. I think that the main issue became is that you didn't believe enough in your product that you allowed Tomorrowland's box office to ruin the idea of bringing Tron back when you should have. You should have let Kaczynski just finish what he wanted to do so that you didn't wait. I mean, Tron Legacy...
15 years?
Exactly. And that's the problem, is that... We just live in such a different world, right? Because there's so much more media being made now than ever before. And that is a detriment to people having things have sticking power, right? It also, it's the kind of the same thing that's in my thought process, in my mind, for how in the world is Stranger Things actually going to do? You know, because it's been so long since that that last season came out. People have been waiting so long for that. Is it going to be one of those things where there's all this pent-up desire, or have people kind of grown out of it, you know? And I think that, you know, Legacy obviously wasn't a massive hit for Disney in the first place. But if you were going to build on anything, it would have helped to have built on it 3 years after Legacy instead of 15 years after that. And I really just think that's the issue, you know? And like you said, there wasn't anything big that was in the way of Tron Ares. What was in the way of Tron Ares is just not striking while the iron was lukewarm. You know, the iron's cold now. And I think that's really just what it comes down to, which is disappointing because I agree with you. This is not a bad movie. This movie didn't feel like it was just all obsessed completely about only setting up what came next. I thought it, you know, because of the fact that it wasn't just about following up all the things we got from Legacy, it was kind of like about crafting a new part to the story. All of that was really, I thought, interesting and unexpected in that sense. But I just think we're in a spot where you can't be spending this much money on these type of things anymore and just expect to do well. I think you have to be reminded that we live in an oversaturated period for media, and what you have coming out really has to stand out these days, because, you know, it's not like we haven't seen this struggle even in the superhero genre, right? You know, Marvel has really struggled with this, and yes, Superman even struggled with this last summer. We're just not seeing people show up for, you know, the movies in the same way that they used to be. And so maybe it's time for studios to possibly rethink and just create less spectacle and more drama, you know, less spectacle and more heart, you know, less spectacle and I, you know, I don't know if any of makes sense.
David Mamet said something about this recently. It's the fact that special effects used to be a draw because great visuals used to be a draw because you had a generation that was discovering it as the innovations were being made. Now you have a generation that the special effects have always been there in movies their entire lives. So that's not a selling point anymore. That's what Mamet said. He said it needs to be, you need drama, you need a good story, you need characters that will engage and pull people in. Because look at the movies that have been doing really well this year. You know, F1, Sinners, Weapons. You know, it's stuff that, you know, they rely on really good writing and really good acting and really interesting characters. And it brings the boys to the yard. So,
I think you're making a great point in that sense. And you're kind of like really there with what I'm saying too, is like when you think about the things that are actually doing really, really well for the most part, visual effects wise films, tend to be the movies like, I mean, just look, the Avatar movies continue to make lots of money. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the next one. But Way of Water did the same thing that the original Avatar did, which is like, it gave people a world to be completely sucked into and was so astounding visually that they couldn't get enough of it, right? And so they would go back to see it again. And that's the type of thing where it's like, you know, Cameron at least gets that. And so at the same time, you know, I also think that Way of Water then took all of the visual elements and created an actually more interesting story, and therefore allowed people to, yeah, when they came back, they didn't just feel like, you know, I'm being you know, duped into seeing the same thing over and over again. And so, you know, in the end, look, the movies that did well this year, it's not been a great year for the box office. You know, the biggest movie of the year domestically is the Minecraft movie, you know, and it didn't even make $500 million. And so, you know, and if you look at the top 10 movies, every single one of them is a franchise film except for Sinners. And so that's just the domestic box office. And a lot of them are incredibly aging franchises, like Disney remakes or Jurassic World or the Marvel franchise or DC or Mission Impossible, you know. And so it does seem like Hollywood itself has a lot to rethink in the end if it wants people to start coming back to the movies. And they better do it soon. Otherwise, you know, I don't know. So all that to say, Scott, because I think we could probably talk about the woes of Hollywood forever and what they're doing or what they're not doing. But when it comes to Aries and everything, where do you come down on your ratings for this movie out of 5 light cycles?
4 light cycles, actually. I enjoy this movie. I could be persuaded to see it again in theaters if I had the time. But the visuals were amazing. The story was interesting. I mean, just look at what the rabbit hole we fell down in on this podcast talking about the philosophical implications of this film. It does its job. It's a Tron movie. You know, it's... I go back to Maximus from Gladiator. Are you not entertained? And it's a good movie. I mean, it doesn't hit legacy for me, but it wasn't trying to. But it's also story-wise and visual effects-wise, it's better than the first movie. And I say that as someone who has incredible nostalgia for the first movie.
This movie does not hit legacy for me either. For me, this lands at a 3.5 out of 5 light cycles. But I think that's a really solid 3.5, which means this is better than an average film. And it's close to being like more on the really good side. Not great, but really good. And it was really enjoyable. And look, the movie's like a tight 2 hours. There's a couple of things that, you know, we talked about where I would have loved a little bit more story thought. But on a whole, I enjoyed this movie. I thought it was a really fun time at the theater. The visuals were great. The soundtrack was fun. And, you know, I am sad that we will never get more Tron, that it seems like this has finally put the nail in the coffin of this series, because I think one more movie to wrap up the storyline would have been really interesting.
But I also hate the idea that the movie is going to get the blame for it, unlike your observation that the blame should be the studio waiting 15 years to make a sequel.
Yeah, agreed. I couldn't agree with more. I don't think it's this movie's fault, because this movie is not a bad movie. And I know it hasn't necessarily gotten, you know, great ratings from the critics. But when you actually look at the audience score for people who went and saw it and then went and rated it on Rotten Tomatoes, you know, the audience score for this movie is 86%. That's a really good audience score. The actual Rotten Tomatoes score for the movie was 52%, and I think Legacy got 54%. And then Tron, I also did not have a great score. So, look, these movies have never gotten great critical reaction, but the audience has seemed to really enjoy them. And so I think that's the other thing, is just this one, people didn't go try it. In fact, honestly, Legacy has a worse score audience-wise than the Aries does, which is 64%, which that's crazy pants and wrong, but that's a different story. I think this is... Man, like you said, the fact that we actually got to have, such a great conversation, a deep philosophical conversation about a movie called Tron: Ares. That's the stuff that I love. That's what makes going to the movies fun, and that's what makes, you know, podcasting about them with a gentleman like yourself just a joy, Scott. And so we're going to be back next month. And in fact, we are going to be talking about another film that's going to be in the theaters. We're going to look at The Running Man there by Edgar Wright. And of course, the great Glenn Powell being in that film. But if people wanted to catch
it twice.
Yes. Yeah. But if people wanted to catch up with you, Scott, and talk about maybe this movie, all the other things that you're seeing, what else you've got going on, where would they find you?
You can find me on X at ScottDC27. You can find me on Vero at Scott McClellan. And you can look up my letterbox, Scott McClellan at ScottDC27. Letterbox is where it's at for me, really. I mean, even if I don't write a review, you can just following along to see all the freaking movies I watch. And I always give a star rating.
And you,
even if I
and
don't
you watch
write a review. I do watch a lot. It's my happy place. And then, of course, every Wednesday at a new time. Now we're moving up an hour to 9 p.m. Central Time, 7 p.m. Pacific, over on the Film Junkie YouTube channel. The DC Fanimated stream is still going strong. We're about midway through the second season of Batman Beyond. We're like 3 weeks away from pivoting back and doing the two-part series finale of Superman the Animated Series. So if you want to tune in for that. And this past week, we just had a live interview with Ernie Altbacker, writer of Batman Azteca, Clash of Empires. So we did a deep dive, spoiler-filled discussion about the making of that animated film. And if you have not checked out Batman Azteca, it is not streaming on HBO Max yet, but as of this past week, it is now available to rent if you don't want to, you know, put down the money for a purchase. But it was not what I thought it was going to be. And I told Ernie this to his face in our interview, and I was pleasantly surprised by this animated film. So I would suggest you check it out and then check out our interview with Ernie over at the DC Fanimated stream.
Man, that's great, dude. You could find me, of course, all over social media under the name MattRushing02. If I'm on a social media platform, that's my name. So check it out. You can also, of course, find me here doing a lot of great Star Trek talk here on the TFM network. Plus, you know, we've got the Indie Files going on as well as every month. Yancey Evans and I are diving into the Indiana Jones extended universe with the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. So we hope you'll check that out as well in this same feed. So just be subscribed to the 602 Club
that
and you'll get it.
That blew my mind that you'd never watched an episode.
I know, right? Things happen. Of course, you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network as well. I've got a couple of shows there, actually, just two. You can find me doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. We talk about Star Wars each and every week. And then I've got a completed show called Owlpost, where we talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. But thank you so much for joining us. And fight for the users! We'll be right back.